simple question today. It's a really simple question that people throughout every generation have grappled with in the church, and it's this. What is it, or how is it, that the gospel message is actually spread? In other words, the real working out of the gospel, how does it get from one generation to the next, from one person to the next, and is it possible that, well, it just never makes the jump? Now, is it possible that things could die out, let's say? And so we're going to look at the early church, we're going to look at what they had to work with, and then we're going to get into what our responsibilities or roles are today, maybe. So we've said this before, but first century, church begins. You know, and it's written on your paper there, but we'll write it up here. Early Christians have a couple of things to work on. They have the law. They have the teaching of Jesus. Now, obviously, that breaks down pretty quickly because as soon as Jesus is taken up to heaven, now they're relying on the teaching of Jesus as transmitted through the apostles. And their teaching, their commentary also. So, the way in which they interpret the law. And then the final thing, which I think is on your page there, there is the Spirit showing up and in one way or another, filling people, empowering people, doing things that could not be done in any other way. So we'll just put Spirit there, and that represents a lot. And we're going to call that experience, personal experience. And we said last week that there is a relationship between experience and doctrine. Does anybody remember what that is? Anybody here last week? Did anybody hear what I just said? Okay. All right, never mind. I'll just answer my own question. It's so much easier that way. I'll just pretend that you're all engaged here. All right, so doctrine is essential because without doctrine, we don't know what we believe. I mean, in the same way, and let's use doctrine in the loosest of terms, right? Without a building code, buildings would look and function pretty differently than they do. Your neighbor's building might look and function very differently than yours. You might not want to live next to your neighbor. So when we look at doctrine as simply the way things should be, the way things ought to be, and what we can count on, doctrine is essential. All right, so don't look at doctrine as a bad thing. I mean, when you hear the word doctrine in church, it usually elicits, like, I think it's time to take a nap thoughts. But doctrine is actually good if it's presented and handled well. But doctrine apart from experience is just boring rhetoric. All right, so just to illustrate this, what do you do for a living?
Maintenance staff.
Okay. Do you start your day by reading maintenance journals?
No.
Why? Ah, well, see, you don't even know why, so you don't count. Mechanic. Do you start your day by reading automotive journals? No. See, we don't really tend to generally invest a lot of early morning time, our waking time. We don't invest it in that. Why? Well, it's sometimes, let's be honest, we think it's boring. Right, I do this all day long, I don't necessarily want to read about it. So what brings life to and what drives us back to doctrine? Experience. All right. So when we experience the gospel, it excites us and drives us back to discover more about the doctrine in the gospel. When we experience challenges in life, it drives us back to doctrine. But without experience, we wouldn't have a desire for doctrine. So there's definitely a relationship. Our life experience and the doctrine or the belief system that we hold are integrally related. One without the other soon disintegrates. And so we see that in churches that are heavy on doctrine but light on experience, and no one wants to go there. Why? Because it's all a bunch of teaching to fill your head but nothing else. And it looks that way. But then there are churches that are heavy on experience and light on doctrine. And what does that look like? Well, it's fluff with no substance. It's feel good. It's happy. But there's never anything that you can really say confidently, this I believe, this I hold fast to. Now, we don't want that in anything, because without a foundation, anything can blow over and topple. All right, so this is what these guys have got to work with. So if you have that written down, if you were going to write it down. Jason, I am without an eraser here today. How did that happen? Or no, it's up there. That's why I'm without an eraser, because I've already put it up there, because I was prepared. All right, so I know you're all confused so far and think this isn't going anywhere. Just hang on a minute. So where does the gospel message emanate from or originate from? Territory. Jerusalem, Judea, right? That's where Jesus said, stay in Jerusalem until, and once you've gotten the until, in other words, once you've been filled by the Spirit, then gradually, once you've worked from Jerusalem, and then Judea, and then moving out, etc., etc. So in Jerusalem, is it safe to say you'd be able to find Jews? Right? I mean, you're laughing, but right? Of course. So here's the challenge. As they move further and further away from their hub with this gospel message, they found less and less Jewish community. See, the gospel starts out with people who have an underlying doctrinal bias toward the law of God. Remember, we said the law of God is one of these things that the early church is built on. Right, but as they move into Greek territory, we'll say, as they move throughout the Roman Empire, there's less and less knowledge about the law. Now what do they do? Okay, see, when I'm talking to you about some technical issue related to your field, I can appeal to all your knowledge about it. But what if I'm trying to explain something to you and you have no technical experience in that? See, it creates a problem. Right? It's like you trying to explain to the customer why their car is broken. And pretty soon you're reduced to, well, the widget over here isn't connected to the widget over there, and therefore this thing doesn't turn and that doesn't work anymore.
It's harder.
And so underlying all of this is this simple idea. And it's actually shocking how often you see it in the Gospels, and then you see it reappear in Paul's letters, in Peter's letters, in John's letters. And it's this idea of love. So we're going to spend some time today looking at love and the idea behind love. We're going to see why it's so hard, and yet why Jesus... And when he's teaching these words to his followers, I'm confident that they don't understand why love is so significant. Because they don't even understand what their mission is. Their mission is going to be to go out and reproduce in other people what Jesus has produced in them. And yet, there's no commonality there. It's like Pat here trying to talk car stuff to somebody who knows nothing about cars. And maybe even talking car stuff to somebody who knows nothing about cars in a different language. Where he's reduced to little sketches. And say, well, this is... No, forget it, I can't even talk. So he just is reduced to drawing. That's what it's like to try to transmit the gospel message from one people group to another people group, because there's no underlying foundation. And so Jesus, in one way or another, comes back to this central theme. There's only one common thread that's going to connect you and the rest of the world. And it's the idea of love. All right, so most of this text here is that I'm going to ask us to look at least initially, is on your paper here. So we'll start with the Luke 10:1. And behold, a lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said to him, What is written in the law? Now, this was actually a pretty legitimate exchange. And it's typical of the way a lot of church actually works. By this advanced time, In the evolution of teaching of the law, there were people who sat around all day long and basically discussed the law. I mean, it would be like church leaders just sitting around all day long and discussing various nuances of scripture verses, and that's what they did all day long. Here's the big question, the question that they're asking. Are there important laws, and are there unimportant laws? How do we do that today? Come on. Are there big sins and minor sins? Are there big sins that I really, really need to avoid as opposed to minor sins? Well, maybe I could skate by on them. Are there really important things that we should be focusing on, these teachers of the law are saying, and are there less important things? And they would debate about those. And so they'd sit down together, and they had just exactly like we do in this room, having various perspectives and various experiences, and they would sit down and they would bat this stuff back and forth. And so on this particular day, Jesus is with them, and he's treated just like a fellow, another person in the group. Did you want a handout, which I neglected to offer you? Oh, you were... Oh, see that? See that? Would you give that to my buddy there? And behold, a lawyer stood up and put him to the test and saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit an eternal life?" Now, Jesus, in the form that would have been typical for that time, puts the question back on him. And he said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" In other words, how do you interpret it? Okay, you know the law. I know that you know the law. So what are your feelings on it? What are your thoughts on it?
What did your parents just say? What do you think you should do?
And he answered him, "You shall love the Lord..." Well, I see I made a few typos there. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." Incidentally, this is for the sake of trivia. Luke's rendering of this is the only place that you'll find heart, soul, mind, strength. Luke being written to a Greek audience... My belief is that the Greeks addressed things slightly differently, and so he wanted to make sure that he was capturing the essence of this. That's why you'll see it rendered differently in other Gospels. Only Luke has these four components to the human experience. What's he really saying? So how is this man summing up the law? And Jesus puts a stamp of approval on it. Yeah, that's a good answer. What's he saying? How do you love God? With all of your humanity, with everything that is in you, you are to love God and your neighbor. All right, so we'll read another one. "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees..." So this is not a friendly confrontation. The first one that we're looking at in Luke is just a friendly exchange. It gets a little testier later on. But this one in Matthew is clearly hostile from the start. "But when the Pharisees had heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. 'Teacher, which is the greatest command in the law?'" So we get back to that. What are the heavy commands? What are the light commands? What are the important ones and the unimportant ones? "And he said to him..." So notice, Jesus doesn't put this back in the lap of the other person this time. He just goes to the answer. "And he said to him, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the great and first command. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depends all of the law and the prophets.'" All right, so now we jump down to the Luke one, and the reason that the Luke 18 one, and the reason that is in there is so that we get a feel for what is the love your neighbor part of it. Because in both of these earlier answers, there's two components to it. Love God. Love neighbor. All right, so suppose you're in the audience that day. What are your questions about that? Yeah. How do you do it? That's it. Right? And if you're the kind that is inclined to be looking for loopholes, don't you want to know precisely how you have to do it and also where you'd be exempt from doing it? What do I have to do? What don't I have to do? What constitutes doing this? All right, so we'll go to the Luke 18 one. "And a ruler asked him, 'Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?'" So one of the big questions, eternal life, one of the other big questions is just which is important, which isn't important. Now, notice nobody's saying, what will be useful for me to do today? These are just high-minded, highbrow discussions. Now, this guy in the what we call the rich young ruler, he seems to actually be at least concerned about himself. At least we'll give him credit for that. He's not just there to have a theoretical conversation. Right? Incidentally, that happens a lot in church. We get together to have theoretical conversations about things we don't intend to ever do anything about once we leave. Don't look at me confused.
Oh, yeah, we're going to study it. We're not going to get involved in it. We're sure he's not going to tell you how to do it.
Okay. And the ruler asked him, good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus said to him, why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone. Now, we've done a pretty thorough treatment of this particular text a little while ago, where we said that the reason that he points to that is he doesn't do anything to address this part about loving God. Jesus jumps immediately into the how do you love your neighbor? Do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, honor your father and mother. And he said, all these things I've kept from my youth. When Jesus heard this, he said to him, one thing you still lack, sell all that you have and distribute to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. It's clear that I don't have my spell check checked. to the poor. this is the ghetto gospel. So where does all this come from? Okay, so this is the greatest commandment, and the second one, which is like it. And so, where does this come from? Is this something Jesus is making up, or does this stem back into Old Testament teaching? And this is why we say the challenge here is the further these guys take their message from the seat of where it originates in Jerusalem and head out into the various regions that they're asked to, the less of a foundation they have to build on. In other words, well, which God do we love? Right? If you're a Greek, which God do we love? And what would that look like? So now we'll go into the Deuteronomy one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. All right, now, if you know anything about Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy is Moses' collection of final addresses to the people before he is going to be divested of his leadership and Joshua is going to take over. In other words, they're perched pretty close to the point where they're going to enter the promised land. This is the last collection of speaking engagements, we'll say, that Moses will have with the people. And in a series of events, he declares these things to the people the final time. He will remind them. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Why is that important in light of where they've come from? Came out of Egypt with multiple gods. Do not be confused. There is only one God. Now, why is that important? Let's read on a little bit, and then I'll come back to that. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. Well, there you go. It's there. Why is it important that there's only one God? Oh, sure. Sure. Well, why not? Right? If you don't know, if you're not confident.
Right. He's saying, look, burn the boats. We're not going back. This isn't. I'm not asking. I'm telling you.
Okay. So why is it important to know that there's only one God? If you're going to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, do you think you might be confused if there were multiple gods you had to do that with and they each had their own personality and you had to love each of them differently? Do you see how you could be a mess by the end of the day if you had to do all of that? As a matter of fact, in Egypt there would be various priests that would be dedicated to serving an individual god. And they all reported to the Pharaoh. So here's this thing where Moses is reminding the people, listen, let me make it simple for you. I'm a simple guy, you're simple people. Let's make this simple. There is one God, just give your best, give your all to Him. These commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit down at home and when you walk along the road. And when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. And then further down he says, be very careful that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. All right, so all these reminders, all these opportunities to talk about that, is he making a big deal of this? I mean, is he making a needlessly big deal of this? Yeah, I left that out because at the moment it seemed like a distraction. But in the middle there, between these two texts, it says, be careful that when you get into the land where you didn't build the houses and you didn't plant the crops and you didn't establish the vineyards, be careful when you get there and you're fat and happy and satisfied that you don't forget the God who brought you there. Now, again, why does he say that? What's right? That's going to be their tendency. When am I most likely to call out to God? When I'm desperate, right? Not just when I'm in an ordinary need, but I'm really desperate. I'm telling you, my prayer eloquence spikes when I'm in dire straits.
And God's talking to Moses. He's had his little sort of repartees. He's had these conversations with Moses along the way. He was like, look, you gotta tell them, because they're gonna forget. So make sure that you tell them this. Be careful that you don't forget who I am.
But there's two components to it. What are most of the laws to address? And here he's talking civil laws. He's not just talking ceremonial laws. So the ceremonial laws deal with the sacrifice, how sacrifices are done, what times of the year, who can sacrifice, who can't sacrifice, all that. That's ceremonial law. That's the part of the law that Jesus came to eliminate. But then there's the civil law. This is how you treat each other. No, don't steal, don't kill, don't do all this other stuff. That's how we express our commitment to each other. Now, as long as they're in Egypt, who's going to define and determine their days? The Egyptians are, the Pharaoh and his subordinates, who are the leaders, right? They don't need to worry about things like, I don't think I'll kill my neighbor today. Why? Because they're under threat of death. You and I are fellow slaves and I kill you, who am I going to have to give an account to immediately? Right? Yeah, the overlord. But as soon as we are a free people, and you and I are out alone in the field and I kill you, I may not have to give account to anybody except God.
Well, and don't forget, somebody told them when to eat, sleep.
Exactly.
And they told them what to do. Now you're out there where nobody's telling you anything. You're in panic. Well, there's nobody here to tell me when to eat, when to sleep, when to work, when to... There's nobody here to tell me that.
So here's the big deal. And I know this sounds like we're talking dry theory, but here is the big deal. If I don't, as a free human being, learn how to love my neighbor, what's going to happen to a society of free people?
Do whatever they want.
They're all going to do whatever they want. There's this interesting phrase, you know it, at the end of the book of Judges. What does it say? And every man did what was right in his own mind. Now, if you were to assemble 100 people in a room and give them a complex problem to solve, would they all come up with the same solution?
No.
And if they were then individually tasked with solving the problem, would they go out and solve it in different ways from each other? Of course they would, right? Why? Because every man would do what was right in his own mind. That's not necessarily wrong. It's just that you cannot have a functional free society where everyone does what's right in his own mind. Because what you think is right, well, sure enough, I did have to point to you. What you think is right is not the same as what you think is right. So when you leave here, you go out and you solve the problem differently. But what if your solution and his solution come in conflict with each other? Then what happens?
The strongest man wins.
Or the cleverest, or something. In one way or another, the person with the most prowess in one form or another, they win. But even before that happens, right, let's say two of you. You start out with good intentions. But pretty soon, your solution are working at cross purposes with each other. Now, what do you start to think about him? That's right, look at him. He's an idiot, isn't he? If he was only a little smarter, he'd see things your way.
And now you're telling all of your friends, like a politician, that he's an idiot, he doesn't know what he's talking about, or she's an idiot, doesn't know what she's talking about, and it turns into that.
And Jason is sitting over here half asleep thinking this whole thing is idiocy.
But now it turns into influence. How do I influence this group over my side? How do I influence this group over my side?
But isn't that preferable to, in one way or another, taking somebody else's life or treating them disrespectfully? Sure. So this whole idea of loving your neighbor as yourself is nowhere near as impractical and ethereal as sometimes we get the idea it is. This is not roses and fuzzy stuff and all that. This is very practical, pragmatic stuff. As free people, if we do not love God and then love our neighbor as ourselves, things start to fall apart quickly. Right, now you can just look out in society. I'm not going to make a comment or more comment on that. You can just look out even in our own country. Is the fabric of our unity tearing? And if so, why?
Well, you have in today's society, you have as many different definitions of love as there are colors of the rainbow.
Isn't that interesting? And yet when God defines love, He's very specific about it.
Well, and he says that men are to love their wives. He uses the word love. Love their wives. Well, how?
As Christ loved the church.
Well, how did he do that? Well, there was a very specific picture of what it looked like to love something. And not, I love pizza. I love
all right, one final verse here we're going to look at, and then we're going to turn in a different direction. 1 John, it's the one at the bottom of the page. We love because he first loved us. Whoever claims to love God yet hates a brother or a sister is a liar. For whoever does not love their brother and sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. And he has given us this command, anyone who loves God must also love their brother and sister. Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ, born of God, and everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. This is how we know that we love the children of God, by loving God and carrying out his commands. In fact, this is the love for God, to keep his commands. And his commands are not burdensome, for everyone born of God overcomes the world. This is a victory that has come into the world even through faith. All right, so God and me. That's a nice package. Right? Everybody agree? God and me is a really great package. But what does John say? It's really impossible to demonstrate any love for God unless you're actually loving others. We're going to get into that definition of others soon. So think of the person that you find most offensive or just difficult to deal with. Got that person pictured? I don't know, maybe you left the house and they were still there in the morning. Do you have that person in mind? Okay, and this is what it's saying. Unless you can find ways to demonstrate your commitment to that person, your love for God is questionable. Now, the scripture actually kind of answers this question, but how do I love God? How do I love my neighbor? Here's something, I don't have it written down in your page, but it's worth maybe you writing down. We love God through obedience and worship. We love others through service and respect. I wish you could be here for the end of this.
Well,
because what?
And because we both know, you know that I watch Andy all the time and I listen to Andy all the time.
There he is. He comes in like the wind and he leaves like the wind. And... okay, one last time. We love God through obedience and worship. We love others through service and respect. All right, so we'll move from the primary focus, which was love God, to how do we love others? Now, this is going to be the key thing. Remember when we start out, we're going to put the... here, you can even have the cap that goes with it. We're done with that. We're going to let this one stand for Jerusalem, and this one stand for Judea. Just leave that to the side for a moment. You have heard it said, love your neighbor. We're on the back side of your page. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes His sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. In other words, Jesus says, listen, I want you to use the example of the way God loves us. Remember what John says in his epistle? He says, God loved us first and demonstrated to us what love looks like. Therefore, we can love. This is just this idea. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. In other words, you can't just pick and choose. Now, this is going to be particularly relevant pretty soon. Remember the question I asked before? Would you be able to find any Jews in Jerusalem? Yeah, you would, right? How is that significant about loving your neighbor? So if you're a Jew in Jerusalem, who is your neighbor likely to be?
Another Jew.
Now, what are Jews going to share in common? Let's make a list of them. The eraser. Maybe we should paint it red, huh? Okay, so you're a Jew. You live among Jews, hypothetically. What are the things that you share in common?
Heritage.
Next.
Religion.
Anything else?
Family. Possibly.
Remember
the time you're looking at a homogenous society, almost like the Japanese.
Remember what we said last week, where we said that Paul says to Timothy, you've got to debunk this constant discussing of genealogies. What's a genealogy? A reminder of where we come from that we all have in common. So family is a big one. What else do you share? I mean, it's even down to little things. Your daily customs. Food. There's all this stuff that you share. Your assumptions about how life works. And finally, out of this religion, actually, even the difference between right and wrong. Now, with that as a list of things that you have in common, would it be possible to love those people? It would be difficult some days, but it would be workable. But you see, that's not quite what Jesus is calling us to. See, when Moses says, I want you to follow God's law, and God's law will teach you how to love your fellow man had all that in common with you. So here was the assumption. Your fellow man was obligated by the same list as you were. You all shared the same background. In other words, you believed the golden rule, and you did too, and therefore you were each looking out for doing for the other what you would like to have done for you. So your neighbor was like you. But the interesting thing is, by the time Jesus teaches this, and we'll start out with the same J, who occupies Jerusalem? Who occupies Judea? And we could even go further. You see, the further they got from Jerusalem, apart from a few cities scattered around where there were significant Jewish contingents, apart from that, the further they got from Jerusalem, the less they would share in common with the people that they were going to interact with. And yet you were still commanded to love your neighbor. In the loosest and the broadest of senses, who's your neighbor?
Everybody.
Let's turn back over to Luke 10. Let's hope I got this right. Okay, now this is the part where the lawyer comes and questions him. We'll just start at, I guess it's verse 25 here. And behold, a lawyer stood up, put him to the test. This is the part that we've already read. Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? And he said to him, what is written in the law? How do you read it? And he answered, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, you have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, who is my neighbor? Okay, now, there's a lot of speculation about why he would have said, but desiring to justify himself. Why?
Sounds like he was picking and choosing.
Okay, well, in the last 24 hours, let me ask you this. All right? This is probably the reverse of the question that you expect me to answer. In the last 24 hours, has someone offended you? Ticked you off in some way? Done something that you found to be undesirable? Why is everybody looking at you right now? Do you have issues? Who drove? Okay, well, you know, you can, if they treat you disrespectfully, you can kick them to the curb.
About 10 miles.
Oh, they'll straighten up before the morning's out. Okay, yeah, so think about this. What if you were posing that question to Jesus, and then this was just rhetorical, this is theoretical. You're having a great exchange about important laws and unimportant laws, but then it starts to sink in, wait a minute, if I'm supposed to love my neighbor as myself, and then I start to think about that one neighbor, that pesky neighbor that I've just had this exchange with, and he's offended me, and I don't really feel like loving him anymore. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, well, who is my neighbor? And we know this story so well, but it's still worth reading it. Jesus replied, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and this man fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down the road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to that place, saw him and passed by on the other side. All right, here's the interesting thing. You know, Jesus doesn't say the nationality of the person who's beaten and left for dead. It's just a person. Now, what would the devoutly religious man or woman who loves God and wants to love his neighbor as himself do when he encountered the unnamed nationality person lying half dead on the road? But in the story, that's not what happens. You know that's not what happens. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him pass by on the other side, but a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. Okay, so there's shock and outrage there because the Samaritans are this half-breed. You know all this story. And so Jesus places this Samaritan in the context of being the hero of the story. Right? It's why we call it today the story of the Good Samaritan, right? We don't understand the disgust that would have dripped off a Jew's lips when he said Samaritan. I mean, it was just really negative in the most negative of ways. And Jesus has just made this guy the hero of the story and said, What's essential? To love God. To love God and to love your neighbor is in any situation where you find somebody near you. Here's the definition of a neighbor. The person is next to you. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, in whatever circumstance you find yourself, your neighbor is the person that's next to you. So the question is, how do you love him? And he went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. So if you operate under the assumption that... Think about the risks that this guy's taking. Right? This is this road that, and I'm sure most of you know all this stuff, but between Jericho and Jerusalem, there's some spots where there were routine ambushes. It would not have been uncommon to find somebody injured. This is kind of like their version of the Old West, you know, where the bad guys set an ambush and they grab the stagecoach's wealth and leave the stagecoach driver half dead along the side of the road and run away. Well, this is Jerusalem and Judea's version of the Wild Wild West here. So this was not uncommon. So would you stop along the side of the road and help this guy? Well, maybe not, because why? Because it might have been a setup. And you carrying your wad of cash because you were on a trip from Jericho to Jerusalem might yourself get ambushed. And this might have all been a setup. But the Samaritan sets all that aside and says, for the sake of helping this guy, I'm just not going to worry about myself. I'm going to worry about this other guy. And so, you know the rest of the story. And so, we don't need to read that. So, here's the big question then. How do I love the people that are near me? What's standing in the way stands in the way of my loving my neighbor? By that definition, remember, your neighbor is not the guy who shares your values, your beliefs, your assumptions about how life works. Your neighbor is the guy next to you. Do you work with any oddballs?
I used to. Yeah.
Okay, I mean that in the most loving and charitable sort of ways. Oddball is sort of a... Do you work with any people who are not at all like you? They don't share your values, you don't share your assumptions about how life works. So, let me introduce the next big idea right now. While you keep this question fresh in your mind, what stands in the way? So for the gospel to work, Jesus says, you must love your neighbor as yourself. Who's your neighbor? We've just established that. It's the person next to you. Have you loved imperfectly in the last week? Have you been unloving in the past week? Whatever the opposite of love is, I don't know what exactly how we'd phrase that. I'll come up with a word and he'll ridicule me because he'll say it's not a word. So we'll just say whatever the opposite of love is, that's... Have you been that this week? And of course we'd all have to say this. If your neighbor is the person that you need to love, if my neighbor is the person that I need to love, that means that they're the test ground for me to practice on. What do you know about practice? Huh? Yeah, but it takes a lot of it, doesn't it? What do you know about practice in the early stages? Has any of you ever had a kid that played a musical instrument? There's a lot of failure, right? Has any of you had a kid that played a musical instrument, started out in elementary school, played a musical instrument? What did practice sound like in the early days? It was, right? There was not a lot of music occurring in the house. Now, what if that's not so far-fetched an example to use to say that that's what our love for our neighbor looks like when we practice? And remember, this is really frustrating, we are the testing ground for their love. Right? That means, has anyone offended you in the last week? What does that really say? It says that they didn't know how to love you well. So if you have offended anybody in the last week, it means that you're practicing how to love and you don't know how to do it well. If you have been offended in the last week, it means that somebody else either has not learned how to love at all or doesn't care about love, or they're practicing love inconsistently. All right, so most of you married here? Some of you married here? All right? In the last, we'll give it a broad range, a month. In the last month, has your wife loved you imperfectly? In the last month, have you loved your wife imperfectly? And yet you're committed to love each other. You actually, I assume, on a good day, kind of like each other, right? Is that a fair statement? I mean, on a good day. We're real here. On a good day, you like your wife. And on a good day, she likes you. There may not be many good days in the month, but there's at least a few. And so we'll assume that you want to love each other. It's not a chore. And yet, even wanting to love each other, have you ticked each other off in the last month? Of course. You and I are the practice ground for other human beings that are trying to learn how to love. Other human beings are the practice ground in which we try to learn to love, and we just don't know how to love all that well. That's the unfortunate truth. What stands in the way of your loving your neighbor? So now that I've written that up, because I seem fascinated with writing everything here, let's make a good list of that. What stands in the way?
Prejudice.
Huh?
Prejudice.
Oh, that's a good one.
What is that
one?
Prejudice.
Okay. Pride. Okay, here's what we're going to do. We got those two up. Before we add more to the list, why does prejudice, tell me what about that blocks our ability to love?
We've already drawn a conclusion.
Okay. About them, about, okay. Pride. So prejudice is my ideas, right or wrong, about the other person. Is that what we're saying? Okay. What about pride? Okay, so in one way,
I don't have to lower yourself to do something for them. In other words, I don't know if I'm putting it right, but I think you get the gist of it.
Okay, so in one way or another, I'm above all of that.
Right.
Okay, is there anything else?
Time. You know, you see your neighbor struggling with something, maybe trying to get his pool open or his lawnmower's broken down and you know how to fix it, and you just don't make the time to step across the yard and say, hey, I can give you a hand.
Anything else?
The core is you're loving yourself before you're loving me. You can sum all this up. You know, just self.
Okay. How do you get beyond this? We could add more to the list. Did I cut anybody off? Anybody have anything else they want to add to the list? All right. Is that all going to go away?
No.
It's not. And when you talk about time, and you talk about, we'll say, self-obsession, here's the reality. What happens when my neighbor's lawnmower is broken and needs to be fixed and he needs to get his lawn mowed for a party at the same time as I really need to leave for work? And if I don't leave for work, then I don't keep my job. And if I don't keep my job, I don't care for my family. So let's just be really honest about this. There are conflicts all the time about who we can love and how we can love them. Right? When we look at the story of the Good Samaritan, what were the priest and the Levite doing out there in the middle of nowhere? They were headed toward Jerusalem. Why? Presumably because they had priestly and Levite-like things to do. Levitical things. There. Right? They weren't out there in the middle of nowhere for no good reason. They were on a mission to do something. So, I think there's a couple of good questions that we need to ask. And I wrote a few down about God, so they're on the back page there. How do we learn to love God? What is it about loving God that's difficult? Okay, so we've put on there why it's difficult to love our neighbor. Can I even add a couple more? Ignorance. And I don't mean, I'm not calling anybody stupid. I mean, you just don't know. Have you ever been blindsided by something your wife said and she said, well, you just didn't, or you didn't think about, and she was right because it never occurred to you. I know you understand what I just said, right? And she's going on and on for 5 minutes and you're thinking, well, geez, I never even thought about that. What, were you up all night thinking about that? I mean, what is up with you? It never even occurred to me. So sometimes we just don't know how to love people. Okay, so with all of this list here, let me start to tie this together with the other thing that I want us to look at. So turn over to Titus. And remember the question that we started with. The question that we started with is, how do we take this gospel message and move it out into situations where people are not like us, we don't understand them, they don't understand us, they don't have the foundation of... Because here's one of the challenges. As you look out today, there's a phrase that's used, people are less biblically literate. Now that's a phrase that only the church could invent, right? Biblically literate. All right, what does it mean? People are struggling to understand right from wrong and redefining right and wrong in their own image. Remember that statement from the book of Judges at the close of the book of Judges. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes, in their own minds. Does that sound a lot like today?
Yeah.
Everyone does what they think is right. Now notice what it says. Everyone does what they think is right. It doesn't say they do what they think is wrong. In other words, everybody is convinced that their way is the right way, the right approach. Go to the first chapter of Titus. This is the challenge that Paul is talking to Titus about. We're going to start at verse 5. This is why I left you in Crete. So Crete's this small island off the Greek coast, south of the Greek coast, in the middle of the Mediterranean. Incidentally, Crete is about 160 miles long. I got curious last night, so I Googled it, okay? So, and give or take, if you look at it, it might be 30 or 40 miles wide. So then I figured, okay, how do I make this real today? So from here, the distance from here, driving to State College is about 175 miles. All right? Imagine having to walk from here to State College and back again to see your territory. Right, that's equivalent to what Paul is asking Titus to do. I want you to travel around the island of Crete. And I want you to establish leaders in the churches in every community, wherever you find a church throughout the island of Crete. Alright, we'll return to this and start to read. This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained in order. That's a really interesting phrase. Let's read it again. This is why I left you in Crete, that you might put what remained in order. What does that sound like?
Just wants to throw out the anchor and make sure everything
is... What's up with that phrase, remained? In other words, it's possible that if left unattended, things are starting to go backward. I want you to put what remains in order. Right? That sounds like the kind of thing you say after the hurricane has come through town. I want you to put what's left back on its stilts and try to make something of it. This is why I left you in Crete, so you might put what remained in order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. I should do a little bit of sidebar teaching here. So Titus and 1 Timothy are written, give or take, at about the same time, which is after Paul comes out of prison from the prison experience that we know about in the book of Acts. And Paul would go back into prison later on, after the book of 2 Timothy is written. But give or take, same time frame, what does a man think about whose whole mission in life is to establish churches, to advance the gospel, when he thinks he might die? And remember, he was in prison under the assumption that he might lose his life in that first prison experience, but he gets out of prison. Is there an urgency about making sure that your life's work is well established? There has to be, doesn't there? And so this is why he writes to Timothy the first time. This is why he writes to Titus. And here's essentially what he's saying. My time on this earth may not be much longer. But the work that we have established is going to go backwards. We'll lose ground. As a matter of fact, it might all implode if we do not make sure that we solidify what we've done and make sure that the next generation understands it. To put what remains in order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife, and his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination, that's what he's supposed to be, for an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach. Okay, so that's what he describes this overseer or this elder as, the steward of God's charge. What if that's all of us? And I know sometimes you and I may not think of ourselves as that, but what if that really is us? Like, how is your neighbor, the guy that we... Where'd I go with it? Oh, it's there. That's why you're here. Right? So, there I am in Jerusalem, and the guy next to me, who's next to me, is a Roman. How do we get the gospel from me to him? Okay, so here's Paul over here, all right? Paul isn't this Roman's neighbor. I'm this Roman's neighbor. The only way that this guy is going to get it is if I figure out how to do this. Remember that list we made about how why we don't love our neighbor? See, we should ask ourselves that. This is really practical. Let's not make this overly spiritual. There's times in our lives when we need to wake up and we need to say to ourselves, what is standing between me and the good work that I should be doing? What is standing between me and actually loving my neighbor? Is it time? Is it pride? Is it just ignorance? Do I not know how to do something? And because I don't know how to do it, I do nothing? What exactly is standing in your way? And then what would you ask next? What am I going to do about that? Am I really committed enough to loving my neighbor that I'm going to let it change the way I live my life? At least a little bit, for at least a little bit of time. I'm not talking overly dramatic. I'm not talking, oh, from this moment on for the rest of my life, I'll live in a different way. That sounds more like a New Year's resolution. We know what people do with New Year's resolutions. I'm just saying, for this period of time. Right? What does the Samaritan do? Do you think the Samaritan dude had something to do that day when he was on the road? Of course he did. And yet he let it inconvenience him. Not forever. Not for the rest of his life. We'll give the Samaritan the benefit of the doubt, assuming that he had a family and he had other responsibilities. So it would have been irresponsible for him to let the stranger on the road hijack the rest of his life. But for a period of time, he asked this question, what can I do in this moment for this man? Yes?
I think one of the things that probably is prevalent in today's society is the fact that I would think that some people expect that if they do something for somebody, it's going to be returned. You know, what's in it for me? And I think that maybe possibly a small percentage keep people from doing things for other people, because you know, if I help you start your truck and it's not running, and I'm a mechanic like this gentleman here, and you know, and I'm going to say, well, you know, I'm wondering what Glenn's going to do for me later today. And that expectation, I think, in a small percentage of people is probably what keeps.
That's why I never let Pat help me start my truck, because I don't want to feel obligated to him later.
It's not loving your neighbor.
You know, the thought of that payback may be in a lot of people's minds, and you know, if I'm not going to get anything out of this, I'm not going to help the guy.
Okay, let's read on. For an overseer, as God's steward, must be above reproach. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered or a drunkard or violent or greedy for gain. And then it contrasts that with what he should be, but hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, disciplined. He must hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught. Okay, so this is a long list. So part of it is what he needs to know. Part of it is the kind of character. All right, so if you were to look at that list, the list of the good things, that he has to be hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. What one of those things are you personally, am I personally weak in that is preventing me from loving my neighbor well? Because look at the goal here. Hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught, so that you may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also to rebuke those who contradict it. So there are those who are going to contradict the word, the good word, the doctrine. Remember what we said earlier on? Doctrine and experience work together. Doctrine and experience work together. So if we want the gospel message to move forward and people disagree with our doctrine, let's make this really practical for today. What's the definition of marriage? Okay? That is a social doctrinal issue. That's a public doctrinal issue. Some people define marriage today one way. Some people define marriage still in a more traditional sense. Okay, that's doctrine. Now, if you disagree on doctrine, but you don't address experience, what do? You shout at each other. You're wrong. No, you're a bigot. You're not moral. No, you're prejudiced. If you deal solely in doctrine, all you do is throw things at each other. But what about if we add experience? Okay, so now I'm tasked with bringing the gospel to you, my neighbor. But we don't agree on doctrine, remember? I mean, you're the Roman, I'm the Jew, I'm the Roman, you're the Jew, whatever it is. We don't share the same doctrine. Therefore, we don't have any point of unity. Experience is the only thing that's going to bring a point of unity. And what's a favorable experience that they can have with us? It's if we love our neighbor. So it's this second component, but be hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. Remember this? Let's go back and actually look at this thing in Timothy, if I can find it, where he talks about how we are to treat each other in family. We talked about it last week, but let's come back to it again. Chapter 5, 1 Timothy. Do not rebuke an older man, but encourage him as you would a father. Younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters in all purity. Now, the funny thing is here, when Paul is talking to Titus, he's talking about people who are already inside the walls of the church. And inside the walls of the church, meaning where people come together and meet, there are people who are divisive. There are people who are contentious. They don't have sound doctrine, so we'll call them ignorant. And this is all inside the church. Remember, he sent Titus out and he's sending Timothy out to address this. And so, how are they to do it? You treat every single human being that you come in contact with as one of these four classifications. Either a father, a mother, a sister, or a brother. Which means that there is a degree of respect and dignity that is accorded to every single human being, even if you violently and vigorously disagree with them. Now, I don't know about for you. Yeah, you don't even need to disagree with me, but a little, and I'm inclined to be less than entirely respectful toward you. It's more than just a little hard, and more than just for you.
Yeah.
So every morning, this is why we've got to... Well, I don't want to say every morning, okay, because we're just not going to do it. several times a week, it would be prudent of us to wake up and really seriously, if we want to do this, if you don't, if you choose not to be the elder, the influencer, the man who is going to influence the spread of the gospel message, but if you choose to do that, you're going to have to wake up a couple of days a week and ask these questions. How do I love God? How do I love my neighbor? What's standing in the way of both? Just those couple of questions. And here's what I can guarantee you. You've heard, if you've been in the church for any length of time, you have heard this phrase, read the Bible and pray, right? That's just like a stock phrase, read the Bible and pray. There's a tornado coming my way, well, read the Bible and pray. There's an economic collapse on the way, well, read the Bible and pray. I'm only being half sarcastic there, but it's the answer to almost everything, right? It is. But just suppose you were every so often to ask those two questions. Today, how could I love God well? Today, how could I love my neighbor well? Would that influence your willingness to read the Scripture to find actual practical answers? See, if you don't have any reason to read the Bible other than to hope that maybe some amazing thing is going to show up on the page, you're less inclined to read it. But if you're actually a partner, see it's the way that Titus words it, or Paul words it to Titus. For an overseer as God's steward. More current day term for that might be for an overseer as God's manager. Must be above reproach. So if you are God's manager and you have a sphere with a bunch of neighbors, you have an area, a territory, and in that territory you have a bunch of neighbors, and you're the manager, then every day you might want to ask, how can I make sure that my little slice of the world runs well and works well today? And that could make all the difference in whether the gospel message is ever received. Because if we try to introduce doctrine apart from experience, people are going to disagree with our doctrine. They simply cannot refute the experience of being loved well. They may call you a bigot if you disagree with them about doctrine, but they're not going to call you a bigot when you fix their lawnmower. Does your neighbor's lawnmower need fixing today? Or?
No, in fact,
you fixed it yesterday?
I didn't fix it. The funny thing was, I got to tell you, I got great neighbors. About 3 weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I came home. He thought I was out visiting my grandchildren because he hadn't seen me. And he cut 60% of my lawn because he thought I was away. He said, I was just having a great day, feeling so good. I came from my house. You know, we all have like 2.5 acres. He said, I just kept on going from my place and cut 60% of your yard. And it's like, I know he's a great guy. Wasn't expecting that. But there you go. You know, he's just a good guy. And I was just surprised to see him cutting my lawn when I pulled up in the driveway. So it's kind of... But I did help him, actually help him with his tractor years ago. But it was kind of funny that we sort of got on that subject. But there you go. You know, just a perfect example of a guy just doing something that he was not asked to do.
And it is the foundation on which further conversation can take place.
Absolutely.
I mean, don't even, frankly, today, don't even waste your time almost with the whole idea of presenting some gospel message until you first invested some in actually just caring about somebody else. Right? And if it doesn't end up leading to a love-oriented relationship between two people, then is it really the gospel message anyway? Is the gospel message, wouldn't you really like to go to heaven? Or is the gospel message, wouldn't you really like to experience fellowship with God and man? Now, because do you really want to go to heaven if you don't have any fellowship here with the people? Do you really want to go to heaven and spend forever with them? I mean, let's just be practical here. Right? Do you really want to go to heaven and spend the rest of eternity with people that you didn't even like here? Huh? It doesn't. But if we did a reboot and we actually started to think, what every day could I do to love somebody else? And it just give yourself some grace. Because the one person that we tend to not love is ourselves. Have you been down on yourself? Have you beat yourself up at all in the last week because you didn't do something right? You're just an apprentice practicing. That's all you are. That's all I am. We're just apprentices. We're getting it right. Trying to get it right. And we don't get it right all that often. So we may as well just acknowledge that. I'm just practicing how to do this, and one day maybe I'll get good at it. But up until then, I'm probably going to really, well, honestly, suck at it. I'm going to suck at loving you. Right? But it's okay. I can deal with that because you're going to suck at loving me. And we're going to get just a little bit less sucky every day at it if we stay committed to the process. And then those that are on the outside will be able to see, oh, maybe there's something to this. And those in our own communities, well, we'll actually have some real fellowship with them. Because here's another question. Have you ever felt starved for significant relationship? Have you ever felt hungry for real relationship? Not talk about the weather or whatever, but just real, genuine, this is where I am, these are my doubts, these are my questions, this is what makes me angry. Have you ever felt, there's just not many people I can talk to about that kind of stuff? This kind of stuff opens it up. Doctrine divides, experience unites.